I want to start talking today about the British National Cycling Team. Now, you might say, why would I bring up the British National Cycling Team? Well, the bottom line is that the British National Cycling Team was horrible for a very, very long time. In unleavened bread terms, Mrs. Witt's kind of, I can see her dander's getting up. She hails from that area, in case you didn't know. But in unleavened bread terms, we'd say they had an affliction. They were just no good. Now, hold on, Mrs. Witt. It's going to get better because change happened. And we're all about change, especially in the spring holy days. We're coming out of them. And what do we want more than anything else? We want to be ready to change. So I'm going to read a story about this British cycling team. It comes from a book. It's actually a very good book called Atomic Habits by James Clear. He's going to talk a little bit about it. So just bear with me on this one. It says, the fate of the British cycling changed one day in 2003. The organization, which was the governing body for professional cycling in Great Britain, had recently hired David Brailsford as its new performance director. At the time, professional cyclists in Great Britain had endured nearly 100 years of mediocrity. Not something anyone of us would want to have said about us. Mediocrity and our growth and who we are and the change that we take. But 100 years of mediocrity. Since 1908, British riders had won just a single gold medal at the Olympic Games. And they had fared even worse in cycling's biggest race, the Tour de France. In 110 years, no British cyclist had ever won the event. In fact, the performance of British riders had been so underwhelming that one of the top bike manufacturers in Europe refused to sell bikes to the team because they were afraid that it would hurt sales if other professionals saw the Brits using their gear. Now, that's bad. You won't even sell them. You won't even take a buck in a sale because it might hurt your brand. It goes on here, though. It says, Brailsford had been hired to put British cycling on a new trajectory. What made him different from previous coaches was his relentless commitment to a strategy that he referred to as, quote, the aggregation of marginal gains, end quote, which was the philosophy of searching for a tiny margin of improvement in everything you do. Now, none of us is coming out of the spring holy days hoping for a tiny margin of improvement in our character and our growth. But this is how he wanted to enact big change. Tiny margin of improvement in everything you do. Brailsford said the whole principle came from the idea that if you broke down everything you could think of that goes into riding a bike and then improve it by 1%, you will get a significant increase when you put them all together. Brailsford and his coaches began by making small adjustments you might expect from a professional cycling team. They redesigned the bike seats to make them more comfortable and rubbed alcohol in the tires for better grip. They asked riders to wear electrically heated overshorts to maintain ideal muscle temperature while riding and used biofeedback sensors to monitor how each athlete responded to a particular workout. The team tested various fabrics in a wind tunnel and had their outdoor riders switch to indoor racing suits, which proved to be lighter and more aerodynamic. But they didn't stop there. Brailsford and his team continued to find 1% improvements. 1% improvements in overlooked and unexpected areas. They tested different types of massage gels to see which one led to the fastest muscle recovery. They hired a surgeon to teach each rider the best way to wash their hands to reduce the chances of catching a cold. Wow. They determined the type of pillow and mattress that led to the best night's sleep for each rider. They even painted the inside of the team truck white, which helped them spot little bits of dust that would normally slip by unnoticed but could degrade the performance of their finely tuned bikes. As these and hundreds of other small improvements accumulated, the results came faster than anyone could have imagined. I told you the story would get better, Mrs. Witt. She probably already knew about the cycling team. Just 5 years after Brailsford took over, the British cycling team dominated the road and track cycling events at the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing, where they won an astounding 60% of the gold medals available. 4 years later, when the Olympic Games came to London, the Brits raised the bar as they set 9 Olympic records and 7 world records. That same year, Bradley Wiggins became the first British cyclist to win the Tour de France. The next year, his teammate Chris Froome won the race, and he would go on to win again in 2015, 2016, and 2017, giving the British team 5 Tour de France victories in 6 years. During the 10-year span from 2007 to 2017, British cyclists won 178 world championships and 66 Olympic or Paralympic gold medals and captured 5 Tour de France victories in what is widely regarded as the most successful run in cycling history. How does this happen? How does a team previously ordinary A team of previously ordinary athletes transform into world champions with tiny changes. Tiny changes that, at first glance, would seem to make a modest difference at best. How does it happen? Why do small improvements accumulate into such remarkable results? And how can you replicate this approach in your own life? The author asks the questions. The 1% rule. You know, if you set a goal, said I want to improve in an area of my life, do the math. If you improved it by 1% every day of the year, 365 days a year, you get out of the last day of unleavened bread and say, I want to improve 1% every day in this part of my life. If you improved 1%, if you could actually measure it, you'd be up around, by the time it compounds, up near 38% in 1 year. The point is, small, minor improvement, day in, day out, leads to big, big change. Now, we're coming out of these days. We've been asked during these days to contemplate what it means to come out of this world, come out of its sins, deal with the sins that this world has thrust upon us, sins that we deal with, habits that we have, challenges to overcome. We all have them. And if we've done it right, we've looked pretty seriously at that. But now we go back in. The day's end tonight. We get to eat our thick, juicy, puffed up bread. And boy, did Dan Creed just perk up. Boy, he was about asleep and he's like, wow, yeah. I know how to keep him awake. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 4. You see, the days of unleavened bread deal with this fact that we face affliction coming from this world. And yet we want to grow. We want to overcome the world. That's the point of the days. Ultimately, to overcome, to change, to grow, to come out of the days inspired. Are you inspired, motivated? Are you ready for 1% every day? What it's going to take, 1% every day. Which may seem kind of mundane, but if you add it up over time, it leads to big, big results. Thanks to God, because God made it that way. God made it that way. But sometimes the mundane just doesn't seem all that great. In 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 16, I think Mr. Black read this a few weeks ago. It says, therefore we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. 1%. What are the areas of your life that you want to improve in 1% per day, day by day? Renewed day by day. It says here in verse 17, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, referring to life, this physical life, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. We came into the days with afflictions. What were your afflictions you came into to the days with? What are the nasty old habits you got to get rid of? What are the bad ones you need to be working on harder? What are the good ones you need to develop? in order to overcome those bad ones. What are they? We came into the days with them, probably are going to still fight those, want to overcome them and want to change them coming out. The days refer to these things as light affliction, and sometimes you kind of think the Apostle Paul must have been joking. Is life really light afflictions? Is sin light affliction? It's not. But he was referring to life. He's saying, whatever we go through in this life, no matter how tough, even overcoming sin and growing and changing and the pain and agony that goes with that, it's a light affliction when compared to the eternal weight of glory, what we're after. He goes on, he says, well, we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. What have you learned during these days that you're going to take out with you, that are going to allow you to be motivated to change, to go through that grind day by day, to be renewed day by day, to go after 1% day by day, and let that growth and that change cumulatively with the help of God bring you to a result that you can come back here a year from now, 365 days, and though you won't be able to measure the 38% change, but you're going to know that change and growth took place. It's not going to be another year where you come into the next year in the days of unleavened bread and the Passover and you think, boy, I just didn't grow enough this year. What's it going to be for you? What's it going to be for me? I'd like to discuss that today, because there's an important aspect of that that we learn in the days. There's lessons related to this affliction. Let's go to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16, because there is a lesson in the days about coming out of this world of sin. Because at the end of the day, just like the Israelites had to come out of Egypt and the sin embodied in that and the weight of that sin and the fact that it could even tempt us and cause us to sin, we have the same challenge that they have coming out of these days, is to come out of this world, to overcome sin, to grow, to make the changes. And that lesson is at the core of these days. We've heard about it already. Deuteronomy 16 and verse 3, you shall eat no unleavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it. That is the bread of the bread of affliction. I know that Larry Luganbill is online, and his wife shared with me that he just told her that coming into this last day that he's done with the bread of affliction. I think he's keeping the days right up until the end, so don't want to get him in trouble there. But, you know, 7 days of matzos. Now, I'm probably a little more righteous than Larry, because I like my matzos now. I never used to. They used to be very much affliction to me, but I put my Trader Joe's organic peanut butter on them. And I really like matzos then, but of course, I like anything with Trader Joe's organic peanut butter. But we've been eating the bread of affliction, picturing affliction, the affliction of sin, the affliction of the bad habit you have, the bad habit I have, the affliction of not being able to grow at the rate we want. That's an affliction. It's a challenge. But why did they have the bread of affliction, that flat bread? It's because it says here, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. Are we going to come out of Egypt, out of this world, coming out of these days, away from sin and on to change and growth in haste? Do we come out of it renewed, energized, motivated? It's what we all want. But if we came into the days motivated to change and we don't come out more motivated to change, we've missed the whole meaning of the days. If we're not more enthusiastic to come out of this world, then we've missed it, right? We missed the boat, because that's the lesson. They had the bread of affliction because they had to get out of Egypt in a hurry. There was urgency. Their lives depended on it. God said, get out. They didn't have time for their bread to rise. That's metaphorical of what we've been dealing with. So I want to look at four lessons related to that as we come out of the days. Four ways in which we can come out of this world in haste, with the goal being growth. Come out of it in haste with urgency. Let's go to Genesis chapter 19. We'll look at the first one. Are you ready to come out of these days and come out of the world in haste? To come out of Egypt in haste? To see your lives transform, to change, to grow? To come to the next days of unleavened bread in a better place? Is that what you come out of the days with? Is that what I come out of the days with? Because if not, we missed the boat. We missed it. It's a big swing and a miss. You know, just like Byron Buxton. Sorry, shouldn't have taken a shot at Byron Buxton. For all you Twins fans. Genesis 19 and verse 1. Talk about haste. Here's coming out of a city in haste. Story we all know. Genesis 19 and verse 1. It says, "Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom." Lot, the man Lot. You know what he's referred to in the New Testament as? Righteous Lot. But let's delve into the life of Lot a little more, because he had a hasty situation. It says, "When Lot saw them, these two angels, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face toward the ground." Imagine how you'd feel if suddenly you realized these were two men from God. These are two angels. You would bow down. You'd feel a little nervous. You'd be like, "What's going on? What's happening here?" Well, it goes on, it says, "And he said, 'Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, then you may rise early and go your way.' And they said, 'No, but we will spend the night in the open square.'" Ooh, now Lot got nervous. I can't leave these guys out in my city. Even though he lived there, he certainly wouldn't want someone out in the open square. Why? Because it's a world that's dangerous. A lot of sin. A lot of pitfalls out there. Verse 3, it says, "But he," Lot, "insisted strongly. So they turned into him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate." Now, he saw the haste. He baked unleavened bread. It says, it didn't say baked leavened bread, because he needed to get that bread made up in a hurry. He didn't have time to rise. He knew they were going to probably be leaving the next day. So he baked unleavened bread, the bread of affliction. Verse 4, it says, "Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, 'Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally.'" You know, we often look at that and say, that's just so crazy. But look at our world around us. Look at as this thing moves and moves and moves in our world. Is that thought so far off that people wouldn't look on someone else and just want them right now for evil? Okay? It's happening before our eyes. They're just not knocking at the door yet. But when will the days come when they knock at the doors? That's where our society and our world's going. We're asked to come out of that. It's one of the primary lessons of the days. Verse 12, we'll jump down. It says, "Then the men said to Lot, 'Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place.'" And it's got an exclamation point. There's urgency. Got to get out of here. Get out of this world. Get out of this city. Verse 13, "For we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." In verse 14, "So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters and said, 'Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city.'" Urgency is set in. Haste, haste. It's time to move. We don't have much time. "But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, 'Rise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city.'" He said, "If you don't get out, Lot, you're going to die. It's over." Lesson of the days. If we don't get out, we're going to die. But the metaphor is spiritual death, right? We know that. So that's why the lesson is given to us year in and year out. And it says in verse 16, "And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city." How come righteous Lot had to be grabbed by the hand? He was righteous Lot. He knew God. Why? Do we ever have to get held by the hand? Does God ever have to grab our hand a bit and say, I know you and you know me, but you're hanging out a little too long? Where are we hanging out too long in the world? We know the end of the story. They did get out of the city. And of course, God fulfilled what he said he would do. Rain fire and brimstone down and destroyed the city. God saved Lot's life. Unfortunately, his wife didn't escape it. But that's the first lesson we learn about coming out of this world in haste. And that is that to leave the world in haste means we have to get out. We have to escape now. Not tomorrow. Not next week. Now. That's the lessons of the day. It's urgent. It's about what we do today. What we do today. And when we wake up tomorrow, what do we do tomorrow? What's the 1% of our life that's going to change with the help of God that's going to help us? Let's go to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17. Leaving the world and escaping it in haste means we do it now. You can almost say it's like we do it yesterday. Do we have that sense of urgency? Do we see the danger of the world around us and the sins in it as we would as we read about Sodom and Gomorrah? Lot, what righteous man, dwelled. He was lingering. God had to grab his hand. Luke 17 and verse 28 talks about the days of Lot and maybe talks about our days here. Jesus said this, likewise as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. That's what we do day in and day out. We eat, we drink, we buy, we sell, we plant, and we build. That's good old America for you right there. But in verse 29, but on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. People didn't see what was about to happen. We come through these days so that we see. We see the danger. We get a sense of urgency. Verse 30, even so it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. Don't be like Lot. Don't linger. Don't go try to grab something. The time is now. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Verse 32, remember Lot's wife. She turned back. She turned back. Verse 33, whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. I tell you, in that night, there will be two men in one bed. The one will be taken and the other will be left. How can two people be so close? One sees it, one gets it, and one doesn't. Verse 35, two women will be grinding together. The one will be taken, the other left. Two men will be in the field. The one will be taken and the other left. Verse 37, and they answered and said to him, where, Lord? So he said to them, wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together. God is asking us to escape now, to come out of the world now before it is too late. Change the habit now, not tomorrow. Now, you don't need to get all the way there in one day, but you can work on the 1%. In one day. What is the habit, the change, the growth that you need in your life? What is it that you're going to work on 1% every day to build and build and build and build the righteous character, to come out of this world, out of the sins of it? You know, as we come out of these days, we understand the concept of coming out of the world. I'm just trying to tie in this concept of haste, right? And we get that. But here's the problem with coming out of the world. Here's the problem. We can look at coming out of the world almost as if you could come out of the world and you could go home and your home is a sanctuary from the world, right? Is it always a sanctuary? See, the problem we face in these days is that we don't need to just come out of the world. We have an added responsibility because the world has come into our homes. The world is in your home 24/7. If you use technology, it's there like never before. You know, It won't mean much to you, but when I say bus route 21A, it means a lot to me. I still remember the numbers from when I was in, Barb's nodding her head. Bus route 21A, there is someone who knows that bus route. When I was in junior high, my parents shipped me off to Minnehaha Academy, and I had to go from Burnsville to Minneapolis, and I took two city buses for years. 35M, still remember the route number, don't know if it's the same one. That was from Burnsville all the way up 35W to Lake Street where it dumped me, and then I would go down the stairs and get on 21A. The only thing is, when I took bus 21A on Lake Street, okay, heading east towards Minnehaha Academy, I went through a pretty rough part of town. And I remember when I was in junior high, maybe I was in 7th or 8th grade, whenever it was I first started taking the bus. I remember as I got near Chicago Avenue or somewhere around there looking and seeing in the building a store, and it said XXX. XXX. And it kind of shocked me. I knew what XXX was, but I'd never seen an X-rated video store where you could go in and watch movies. Now, I couldn't go in, because if I'd walked up there, if I had any inclination, they'd have looked at me and said, get out of here. Most church members, even if they had an inclination, would never walk up to a place like that, because someone might see them. That'd keep them from that sin, right? Just the sheer embarrassment. But there it was, X-rated videos. And occasionally I'd see someone walking in, and it was a grotesque feeling. Ugh. Couldn't wait to get back to Burnsville, to get away from Lake Street, right? That was me, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade. Think about it now. In every corner of your home, any private spot, anyone in this room, if they have the technology, they can bring Lake Street right on into the home. It's there. And it's there in a volume that you couldn't have imagined, because that volume never existed. I think about what young men and young women face today related to a topic like that, the world, where it's at, the access, compared to what I went through. You can't compare them. I'm just bringing out one obvious example. You see, the world isn't just out there and we can escape and run back away from it. It's here. It's in the home. It's what we face. It challenges us. At times, bad habits are created. Habits that cut us off from God. Now, they're not all limited to things like imbibing in something like pornography. But unlike the Israelites who left Egypt in their homes and went away from Egypt, the world has come into our homes. We have a big challenge in front of us. And when we think about it, let's not underestimate Satan. Let's not underestimate him. Because we can think about it and say, well, yeah, of course Satan would want you to open that laptop or to turn on your phone and to take in that pornography. Wouldn't he love that? That's a big bad one. That's one that'll destroy you. It'll destroy marriages. It'll destroy your relationship with God. Satan wants that. It's a big bad one. Corey, we all know that. But Satan's not that dumb. You see, because if he can just get us in our homes, get us distracted away from God, just to take our attention away, just to get our attention over here, focus there, a lot of time here, he's happy. He doesn't need to get us in solely on the big bad habits that can destroy us. All he needs is distraction. So our challenge is urgent. The need to leave Egypt, to leave this world, to come out of it, but also to kick the world out of the home. Kick it out. How will you kick the world out of your home this year? Because it will be key to your growth. It's no longer good enough to just come out of the world. We have to throw the world out. So that means we have to do it now. We have to escape now from the world, and we have to get rid of the world now. Because if we get caught up in these things, even in our homes, we'll be in danger, like Lot. Lot had to be grabbed by the hand and he was righteous. We're not better than Lot. Let's go to Genesis 13. The first lesson is we need to escape and we need to get rid of the world now. Today. And when you wake up tomorrow, tomorrow. And when you wake up Sunday, Sunday. 1% every day. How will we do that? Genesis 13, we'll see the second lesson we learn related to coming out of the world in haste, or in, as I'm pointing out, getting rid of the world in haste. Verse 5 of Genesis 13, we'll look at Lot again. Poor Lot, for being righteous, he gets thrown in a lot of tough situations here. Verse 5, Lot also, who went with Abram, this was before he moved into Sodom and Gomorrah, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And verse 7, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. And in verse 8, so Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Verse 9, is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right, or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left. Abram was a really righteous man. He became Abraham, as we know. And Abram said, I'm going to give you, Lot, the best of it all. I don't need the best. I let you do it. And where did Lot go? Where did he want to go? Well, it tells us here. In verse 10, and Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. In verse 11, then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east. So he was just east of where Sodom and Gomorrah would have been. He chose that beautiful plain. But here was the problem. It says in verse 12, and Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain. And what did he do? And pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. He pitched his tent towards Sodom. His eyes went there. Now he was righteous. He should have known better. But his eyes went there. His eyes went there. In verse 13, but the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord, as we just read. We learn something here because we know the end of the story with Lot. And we learn the lesson about coming out of this world or getting rid of the world, kicking it out of the home. We learn an important lesson about doing this in haste, and that is the essential requirement to pitch our tent in the right direction, to pitch the focus spiritually in the right direction, day by day. Where will we pitch our vision and our eyes over the next year, day by day, as we battle this world 1% every day? What's your goal? What's my goal? What are your goals? What are my goals? To pitch our tent in the right direction, what will we be focusing on? We may have a bad habit to get rid of. What's the good habit when we pinch it in the right direction that we want to build? Did you come out of the days? Do you have a good habit you want to build? A good one that you never had? A godly one? One that will enhance your relationship? What's your good habits you want to build? What's the bad habits you want to get rid of? How are you going to get there? We know we can pray. We can pray for God to give us willpower to help us. But what's the plan? How are you going to work with God? How am I going to work with God? Have we come out of the days in this way? Lot had a major weakness. See, his tent was pitched towards Sodom and Gomorrah. He liked certain things about it. The bright lights, as they say. He saw the bright lights. What is it in the world that is just hard not to like? And I'm not talking about people. We're asked to love people regardless of who they are. We're to be like Christ. What about the bright lights gets you, gets me? Where is your tent pitched? You see, your tent is always pitched where you spend your time. You see, Satan is happy As long as you spend your time with your tent pitched, your mind, what's absorbing the time, the energy of your mind, as long as it's pitched away from God, then he's happy. It's all he needs is for you to be distracted. That's good enough. Where do you spend your time? You ever think about TV? You know, I had a problem with TV that I uncovered recently. Now, I'll tell you about my TV watching habits. Now, I'll add in, as you think about TV, think about it. You can think about it as anything that you view on a screen, whether it's your phone, your laptop, your notepad, your big screen, whatever it is you take in video, or it could be YouTube, it could be Netflix, it could be cable news, it could be anything where your mind is being filled, you're visually being stimulated. I had a problem with TV lately. Now, I'll tell you what, my problem with TV was not necessarily the content of what I was viewing. Now, I'm not trying to paint myself out to be perfect or righteous, but I had a problem. Now, what I'll tell you is, as relates to TV, I pretty much watch three things. And my daughters and my wife will vouch for this. I pretty much will watch Fox News, okay, sports. I get Fox Sports North, so I'll watch the Vikings, the Timberwolves. Now, some people would say watching the Timberwolves is a sin. They're just that bad. And you know what else I watch? I'm going to admit it publicly. And I want all women to give me a hand. I watch Hallmark movies. Kyle, you'll do it someday. I know you don't think you will, but you will do it. Now, what is any of the content there really bad? Is it a sin to watch Fox News from a content perspective? Is it a sin to watch the Timberwolves, really, from a content perspective? Again, some might argue that. Is it a sin to watch Hallmark movies? They're about as clean as you can get. Probably not. But I had a problem. Because you see, you can't look at being distracted by something like TV strictly from the perspective of content. And we like to do that, and that is good, to make sure whatever we're absorbing is before God, we feel a clear conscience. But we look at it in terms of usage rate or frequency. How often? How long are you or I on a device or in front of a TV watching something? What's your frequency? What's your usage rate? What does it do in terms of displacement? Because when you spend your time on the device, it displaces you from something. Is it possible that it displaces you from God? Do we live in a world right in our own homes where the world's there 24/7? Endless amounts of content, things to distract our time. I'm not even talking about social media. We could go on and on and on. I've known people in the church that they wouldn't watch a bad thing at all, but they'll watch news all day, practically. So all they do is intake news, news, news. My problem was this. I'd get up in the morning, I'd grab my coffee, but I had to have a little time to wake up. Because, you know, the brain just doesn't engage for me like it used to. Maybe it never did. So I get my coffee, and I would wake up, and so I'd have Fox News on in the background just to kind of help wake me up with some coffee. And I'd get on my computer and get on the Star Tribune. I know many of you love that, the communist rag. But I'd read the sports. But here was my problem. Okay? How much time did that get to be? And I was already awake. And it got to be a problem because my frequency was too high. And suddenly my time with God that I knew that I should have was starting to dwindle because I would get up against it. Now, that's just one example. We could probably go through multitude examples. Now, I had to make changes, right? Now, in my case, I was able to just say, there's no TV on when I get up. It's got to be shut off. Computer does not open when I get up. Doesn't. So if it takes me a little longer to wake up, fine, but I'll grab my coffee and I'll get to work on what I need to get to work on. If I hadn't been able to keep myself from turning that TV on, what would have I had to have done? You get rid of it. I haven't had to do that. Okay? But sometimes we have to get rid of things. You know, what is it that you need to do to pitch your tent in the right direction? My tent was pitched in the wrong direction, but I wasn't being wise about it. On the surface, it didn't seem like I was sinning, but at the end of the day, it was. Because I took time away from God that in my mind I had allocated, and I was not giving it to Him. James 4, for him that knows to do good and does not do it, it is sin. The days of unleavened bread, sin. For him who knows to do good and does not do it, it is sin. If you know to honor your mother and father and you don't do it, you just don't do it, sin. You don't take the time to do what you need to do spiritually, it's sin. So I had to deal with that. We can get ourselves into habits. What's your 1%? Where do you need to pitch your tent? What old habit needs to go away? Which new habit needs to come in and replace it? This book, Atomic Habits, is very interesting. If you're interested in thinking more deeply about changing habits in practical ways, I would suggest the book. I've told Colleen she doesn't need to do that. Like, she could write the book. I, on the other hand, need to read it 2, 3, 4 times. Okay, so if you're looking at your life and saying, man, I got to change habits, it's actually a good read. It's not a religious book. It's more scientific in many ways than that. So an important thing in these days is to pitch our tent in the right direction. Let's go to Hebrews 11. We're going to look at the third area quickly. The third area. In Hebrews 11, in verse 6, we've read this scripture many times. It says, but without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And it goes on to tell stories about faith. But what it tells you is stories about people, how they took action. Noah, Abraham, Jacob, others, they took action in the face of the world because of faith. So we come out of the days and we want to take action. Now when we pick the story up in verse 30, here's what it talks about. When it talks about people who go into this world, they take it on, but they take it on by taking action. Faith plays out in action. Verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they encircled it 7 days. Action. 31, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. Action. That's why she's listed in the book of faith. In verse 32, and what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, became valiant in battle. Action, action, action. They didn't just say, God, give me faith. They say, God, I'm going to walk in the faith. I'm going to take action. Are we coming out of these days ready to take action? What is your action going to be? And that's the third lesson we learn, and that is that we come out of the days and we are motivated to take more action with the help of God. With the help of God. To let our faith play out in action. It's the 1% every day. Action and coming out with that kind of thinking out of the days implies you have your plan of action. What is it? What is it? What's my plan of action? That's a big question. None of you are going to answer. I'm not going to answer that publicly. But what's the plan of action that you have? If you don't, get it down. Leave this place tonight. Write down your 1% every day. Write down the areas. Do you have it written down? Do you have a plan of action on how you're going to grow? Is it specific? Is it actionable? That's my question for you. It is my question for me. I want to read a story. You know, often we're so influenced by our environment, and action takes place in an environment. Let me read a story about the Vietnam War here, a brief story. And it talks about how our environment can affect the actions we take. Because I'm talking about, we not only have to come out of the world by taking action, but we have to kick the world out of our home, because it's in that environment that big challenges can occur. I would argue that there are more challenges in your home and my home than there are outside. You might disagree. You might say, hey, when you're out and about with other people and that, it's tough, but let's put it this way. There's the potential there's more. Because often we're not careful. We're like Lot. The world's going on around us, even in our own home, and we don't realize we're distracted, that we need to take action. But this story's interesting one. It says, in 1971, as the Vietnam War was heading into its 16th year, Congressman Robert Steele from Connecticut and Morgan Murphy from Illinois made a discovery that stunned the American public. While visiting the troops, they had learned that over 15% of U.S. soldiers stationed there were heroin addicts. 15% of our soldiers in Vietnam were heroin addicts. That's a lot. That's a lot. He went on to say here in the story, it says, follow-up research revealed that 35% of service members in Vietnam had tried heroin, and as many as 20% were addicted. The problem was even worse than they had initially thought. I never knew that. The discovery led to a flurry of activity in Washington, including the creation of the Special Action Office of Drug Abuse Prevention under President Nixon to promote prevention and rehabilitation and to track addicted service members when they returned home. Lee Robbins was one of the researchers in charge. In a finding that completely upended the accepted beliefs about addictions, Robbins found this. Listen to this. Robbins found that when soldiers who had been heroin users returned home from Vietnam, only 5% of them became re-addicted within a year, and just 12% relapsed within 3 years. In other words, approximately 9 out of the 10 soldiers who used heroin in Vietnam eliminated their addictions nearly overnight. Goes against conventional wisdom, right? If you're addicted to heroin, you don't get over it overnight. Why did that happen? The research showed it. Well, they go on to explain it here. It says, this finding contradicted the prevailing view at the time, which considered heroin addiction to be a permanent and irreversible condition. Instead, Robbins revealed that addictions could spontaneously dissolve. I know you're still skeptical, but when you hear this, you won't be. They can spontaneously dissolve if there was a radical change in the environment. You see, an action happened. The action was simple. They went from Vietnam back home. A radical change in the environment. Okay? In Vietnam, soldiers spent all day surrounded by cues triggering heroin use. It was easy to access over there. They were engulfed by the constant stress of war. They built friendships with fellow soldiers who were also heroin users. And they were thousands of miles from home. Once a soldier returned to the United States, though, he found himself in an environment devoid of those triggers. And when the context changed, so did the habit. Think about your home. What in your environment needs to change? Where do you need to take action? You know, I remember telling the story years ago about when I had Zach Evans living with me, and Zach wouldn't mind me telling it. But he would talk about video games, and I never understood all the obsession with video games because my daughters were never really interested. I grew up in a generation we really didn't play them, but Zach would tell me that all the guys, his generation, pretty much played video games. And I'm like, Zach, what's the big deal? You know, wouldn't you rather be out shooting a little hoop, you know, doing something a little more fun than just sitting around? I didn't get it. No, it's just our generation, Corey, and whatever. I said, well, tell me about a game. Like one of the tamer video games. And he said, well, Call of Duty, you know, that's kind of a war one, but it's tamer. I said, okay, I want to see it. I want to play it just so I know what it's all about. Never played one of these things, guys. I couldn't play it 5 minutes. I don't think I could play it 2 minutes because my system was shocked. To me, Call of Duty was excessively violent. It was. Now, I was sensitized to it because I'd never played it. And it revolted me enough that I didn't have any desire to develop a desire to play it. I'm not here to pick on anyone who plays video games. You have to make that call yourself. I'm sure some of you do. I don't know. I haven't talked to any of you about your video game usage, so nothing specific in mind, but I'm sure some of you do. You have to make the call. What's the content? What's the frequency? How does that content or that frequency displace me from God? Because again, all Satan wants is to get distracted. So are your video games, and I'm just picking on one example, are they distracting you from God? Not that we need to spend all day, every day, outside of work or school or whatever, with our noses in the Bible, praying and fasting and meditating for, 15 hours a day. That's not my point. But I think we all get the point. What action needs to take place? Maybe you decide, I just don't need to play video games quite so often. Same like with TV or whatever else. But what if the addiction is just too strong? What might you need to do? You might need to put it in a box and get rid of it, if it's displacing you from God. What is the action in your life? What needs to change in your life, in your environment? You see, again, the world is there. I'm convinced the studies go back and forth on how a video game, a violent video game, will affect whether someone else will become violent. But one thing the psychologists will agree on is it does desensitize people towards violence if it's a violent video game. And it reduces empathy, sensitivity to other people's suffering. That's what the scientists will agree on. So we have to take action. Again, what will you take action on? Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11 again, probably already there, and quickly take a look at the last of the four areas. Now, in Hebrews 11, we talked about these people who did these incredible things. They took action. Whether it was in the environment that they were in, or maybe it's, again, you have to change the environment around you, you have to take action. But in verse 1 of Hebrews 11, it says, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible." And jumping down to verse 13, what does it say about these people? These ones who took action, these people of faith. Verse 13, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland." And so people who maintain faith, people who take action, people who have that sense of urgency, they're coming out of the world in haste. It's now, now or never. Maybe 1% a day, but it's now or never. They have their eyes on something bigger. It says, "And truly, if they'd called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." You know, if there's anything we take away from the days, it's this. It's if we want to come out of Egypt, the world, in haste, if we want to kick the world out of the home, we want to change the situation, change habits, reverse and re-engineer the environment around us, we have to have vision. Something has to motivate us towards it. There has to be a reason you'd want to kick the world out. And it's vision. It's vision for a future for us. You know, it's interesting when you study into the census. This tells us a little bit on how God may work as relates to vision. I'm going to find it right here. I'm not finding it. So I'm not going to find it. But basically what it is this. We have five senses, right? One of those is vision. We see. And we have about 11,000 sensory perceptors, 11,000. Of the five senses, and that embodies all five senses, how many do you think involve vision? 10,000. You see, vision, God made it such that even in the body, that the number one thing that's critical in our sensory perception is vision. It's no different spiritually. It's no different spiritually. Do we have vision? Not only vision of the future, but a vision of who and what we want to become today. What will drive us and motivate us to come out of the world? To kick it out of our home, to change, to overcome, to grow, has to do with vision, who we identify with as a person. Think about it this way. What if one of your goals is to study the Bible more? Very good goal. You know, if you could just add 1% every day for a year, that'd be a lot. But it wouldn't necessarily, in itself, mean that when you're studying it, you're getting the things out of it you need to get out. Because a lot of that depends on the motive. Why? Why do you want to study your Bible more? 1% every day. Increase your study by nearly 40% a year from now. Wouldn't that be great to come in to next year? Man, I really spent the last year studying my Bible more. Came out of the days, motivated. I had vision of where I wanted to be. I had a goal. But how much we get out of that depends on why it is we want to do it. What if the reason you wanted to do it was not just to read your Bible more because you know it's a good thing, it's a godly thing, but what if every time you picked that Bible up, you said, you know what my goal is in this? My goal is that I actually want to become more like Christ. When I lay the Bible down today, my 1% more, I want to know that I'm that much more like Jesus Christ. I think that much more like he did. My 1% isn't just I read it 1% more, but I think 1% more like Christ. His thoughts, his attitudes, the way he wants me to think, it's changed. It would be like this, what we read in Romans 8 in verse 29. Think if this was the goal, or this was behind the goal, the why. Verse 29, for whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. What if that was the goal? Whatever the goal ends up being, the reason behind it, the why, was to conform to a different identity, to actually become someone different, to actually change. Change to what? To the image. Conform to the image of Christ, the very essence, the character, the mind, the heart. Again, we could spend all kinds of time going through these. You know, we've come through some incredible days here. You know, in conclusion, the days of unleavened bread, they do picture overcoming our afflictions. We know that. We've come through the days, our old habits, our old sins, our old afflictions. We came into the days looking at that. The question is, how will we come out of the days? The bread of affliction, which will be over soon, Dan Creed will be happy. The bread of affliction itself reminds us to come out of this world, but to do so in haste. That is the lesson of the days. It's the lesson of the bread of affliction. It's not just to come out of the world, or as I said, kick the world out of our lives and out of our homes, but it's to do it in haste. Now, not tomorrow, now, today. Because that's what it means to do something in haste. We have no more time. The time to change is now. As we leave these days, let's dare to escape now. Let's take that bold move. Let's dare to pitch our tents in the right direction. Let's do that. That's a daring, courageous, bold move. Let's be serious and dare to take action. A lot of action, to know our action plan day in and day out, 1% every day. And let's dare to have vision, not just of the future, but of what's going to get us to that future spot, a vision of our identity, what's going to motivate us spiritually to do the things we need to do, to make the changes to come out of this world. By doing this, we will experience change, real growth, one day at a time, one step at a time, and 1%, one small change at a time, that adds up to something really big.